Well, he remains quiet. Then he sees an osprey plunge and bring up a fish. And he feels that's a sign that I have to speak what I've seen. What is below
337
at the top. What is below is born upward. Now we have a new theme, Philemon. Remember, these figures are speaking a partial truth. So we've got to hear what they're saying and at the same time be suspicious of what they're saying. And then pluck out what is valuable. So Philemon starts talking about gold. And I would understand all of this as convincing Jung, trying to convince Jung that he's got to speak. It's support of his statement that what is below is born upward. And that he's discovered gold, and just like physical gold is greedily demanded, there is a need for him to share what he's just understood. And that's pretty much the whole column there till where he says, but I.
I really care like the last sentence in the first full paragraph where it says, it ruins those to be ruined and helps those on the rise to ascend.
Mm-hmm.
And that really struck me as, you know, that's the non-compassionate side.
That's faithless eros. In fact, now we get into faithless eros. You know that phrase from Jung? That to be true to life, sometimes you have to hurt people. The simplest level, a surgeon knows he's causing or she's causing pain, but it's pain in the service of a higher development. I think I told you, some of you, when I left home, my dad said to me, you know, sometimes you have to hurt the people you love the most. Meaning, I'm a mother's son, and it would be painful for my mother to have me go. But go. And if you stop your development because it causes pain to somebody, it can kill you. And so eros, your relationship to life, has to be able to act as if it had no faith. And I think that's particularly important in our field, in the helping profession. We've got to know when to help and when not to help. I remember, I may have mentioned this in another context, that one of my fellow students had developed crippling arthritis by the time he was 16 or 17. I mean, he walked like a robot. He was in constant pain. What's so interesting, too, is he was the son of a major theologian whose theology is flux. And he said my dad projected everything that didn't fit into his theology on me. And he became viciously rigid and got into Jungian analysis, and with vitamin between analysis and changing his diet and vitamins and so on, he could move, but he would move very stiffly. And then I knew him in Zurich. And he told me the one of the critical moments in his therapy, when he was moving from rigidity to softening, he fell apart one night. And he said the emotional pain was too much, the physical pain was too much, and he called his therapist up and wanted to see him. His therapist said no. And he said, by getting through that on my own, I recovered some flexibility. See, that's faithless eros. But the loving thing was to say no. And so what this discussion at the bottom of 336 and the first column over to the second column, when do you teach and when do you not teach? And I think disavow means not teach, not help. Because Jung has just realized he's got an important truth to share. How does he understand his responsibility for sharing that now? See, he's changed a little bit, I think. And he's realizing that by using his gift the wrong way, it can have an adverse effect on other people. And the art is knowing how to live so that when you give, it is an enhancement of the other person and not destroying them. And he says, now remember, this is confused thinking. He's looking at all possible angles until he gets to the conclusion. He says, if I teach, I must give to others what they should have taken. So by giving, you can undermine a person's ability to get what they need.
Could we say that withholding also can be an enhancement of the situation?
Yes, that's what he's realizing.
Okay.
I remember he never wanted to have anybody project the father on him.
Yeah.
And he just constantly resisted people doing that to him.
Yeah.
So that they would be more independent.
Exactly.
Not dependent on
and not only the father, the self.
Pardon?
Oh, you, the self. Oh, you wise leader. There's a letter in the collected works to this guy Vasavada, who was in Chicago area, where Vasavada addressed him as, "Oh, holy master." Jung responded. In a way, we do at times have to accept an idealization, and at times not, and you've got to know when to do one and not the other, and when you've accepted the idealization, you've got to be absolutely clear you can take it and give it back. And all of this is coming later. But what he's wrestling with now is this, the ambiguity of giving and how giving can have very adverse effects. Probably also heard my story of, not ago maybe, of that first therapist I worked with when I was in grad school, had been a preacher, and when he was a preacher, somebody slipped $500 under his door. Remember that story? And he said, I didn't need the money. So I knew a young couple in our church that was struggling financially, so I slipped it under their door. They got divorced, arguing how to spend that $500. See what I mean?
It might have been a good thing.
It might have been a good thing.
That was the perfect thing. They can't come together over $500, all of them.
But see, when you have this Christian idea of charity, you don't think about what other consequences could result from your generosity. No, I think, in fact, Jung was a very generous person, as far as I've heard from those who knew him. But one has to be careful. And that's what he's coming to realize.
Right, and you can always smell it when somebody gives you something just to, and then expects something in return, or has some other I think it's that kind of thing.
That's what he's wrestling with. I've heard that called give to get. Or think of noblesse, the arrogance of the aristocrat giving to the people below him, and you better stay below me if you want me to keep giving to you. Stay in your place. So, again, that is going through his mind. Now that he realizes he has something to talk about, he's realizing the ambiguity of talking about
it. It's very complex because there are times when withholding is the wrong thing to do.
Wrong, yeah, absolutely.
You think yourself that you're withholding for noble purposes when you're really withholding.
Yeah, when you're just a selfish jerk. It is very complicated.
You go through this a lot as a parent. Do I help? When do I hold back? When do I let them struggle? And over small things, and age appropriately, that you know just snowballs as they get older.
Mm-hmm.
And you know it's a fine line because you can set up childish, you know, just this childish, this child-parent relationship that lasts forever, and that's not what you want.
Yes, indeed. Well, I think you've got the main idea. So, where he's going now, let's just look a little bit more at the critique. He talks about the danger of Christian morality in the first large paragraph in the second column. And the next paragraph, kind of in the middle of that paragraph, the soul of the individual becomes damaged since man thus learns always to live from the object instead of from himself. These are all just the thoughts, which I'm sure you don't find odd, having looked at your own personality. Now, the solution starts to appear with his discussion of the self. That our first responsibility is a development of who we are. And, you know, the end of that next to last paragraph, one does not live oneself, it lives itself. So that when the generosity is based in my conscious relationship to my selfhood, there's a better chance it will be. I don't give to fulfill myself. I'm already fulfilled, and I give my fullness. You see, it's complete attack on Christian selflessness. And the idea of pridefulness and I worked with a nun once who was a nun before Vatican, whatever it was, when they got rid of all that hocus pocus. And she said, you know, we are in the habits, and if we looked from side to side, that was prideful.
That was
prideful. That was worldly. That's an extreme, but it's not a rare extreme. So he's just trying to understand, how do I contribute with a positive result? And so the self-forgetting virtue is this, you know, give of yourself, and so on. But he's seeing how unnatural that is. And now again, working on the
just the footnote 29. I just found it interesting where it came up for him when he first said he undermined it. First interested in the concept of the self through Nietzsche.
It's very interesting. That's something I'd like to try to get clear. How is the concept of the self developed? And it looks like, as you alluded to, that he first got the idea in Nietzsche, which would have been 1898. I think that's the first time he read Nietzsche. But he really hadn't conceptualized it as he did later at that point. Yeah. And here, too, I think, when he says the self, that was first mentioned on page 291 and 311. As far as I know, this is the first time it's in print, but I can't be sure.
Here in this footnote, he goes on to compare it with the Eastern concept, which evidently he already knows about.
I don't know. I guess so.
He says, I saw then also that he was producing a concept of the self, which was like the Eastern concept. It's an Atman idea.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
But was that footnote added late?
Well, that was from the Nietzsche seminar.
This is what Jung says about
Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. So that was later. Yeah.
But certainly, he says expressly, I read this in English, I can remember where I read them, that he got the idea of the self from Hinduism.
Right.
Yeah.
But when? That's what we're wondering.
Right. About. I suspect later, but I don't know.
Well, I guess it was prior to his first readings of Nietzsche, because that's what he's commenting on.
Yeah.
So if his first readings of Nietzsche were in, well, I guess it depends on which text we're talking about. It would be prior to 98.
Yeah, see, 98 he would have been 23 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it may not have been his first readings of Nietzsche. I'm sure you've all had that. The idea or the experience of when you read something and something hits you, but you don't quite understand it. You read it years later and you're like, oh.
Yeah, and he says expressly, I didn't know what text I was reading.
But it struck him nonetheless.
Yeah. The more I do this French literature stuff, the more I think Nietzsche is the only guy who knew what the heck was going on. You read Sartre, Camus, Kierkegaard, Buber, all these other guys that I've read along the way in theology, and they never really came up with what that guy came up with. So, as Edinger says, he certainly owes an immense debt to him. Let's see, I got lost again with Terry Way with all these detours. Footnote 29, so at the bottom of 337. The self-getting virtue is unnatural alienation from one's own essence. That's what we've been saying, right? You're always geared, as I'm sure many of you were, to give, then you've actually harmed yourself. Again, now coming to resolution, the work of redemption, 338, first column, the work of redemption is always first to be done on ourselves. And then the next paragraph, where I summarize those first sentences, and it won't be pretty. That's for sure. And in the next paragraph, I think it would be most correct and most decent to say that one blunders into the work of redemption unintentionally. And the danger is that, as he says in the next verse, in the next paragraph, we should, consequently, we should also not use the other for our own supposed redemption. The other is no stepping stone for our feet. And then, so next line, one sentence paragraph after that. In terms of the self, selfless love is a veritable sin.
It's really hard to break that.
It is very hard. First of all, your conscience will call you bad. And second of all, you have to recognize that our own life has amounted to nothing. And so I have to start taking responsibility for that fact and making something of my life. I mean, it's a disease in my profession. Helping profession, some of these people are just lethal. You know, they will cure you, and if you're not sick, they'll make you sick so they can cure you. I'm serious. I talk to some of these people, I have this horrific negative reaction.
I love what Barbara Harris says in The Cat. If nothing can do to help yourself more, is become self-reliant. Mm-hmm. And that's the best way to show love.
Yeah, I think then the love that comes out of a self-reliant person is of a different quality. It frees you up. And if it doesn't, when you receive the love, you're always receiving a debt. And if you don't respond with love, then you're guilty. You're a horrible person. It's epidemic.
I say it's the difference between a dog and a cat in simplistic terms.
That's a very good analogy.
You know, I mean, we are a bunch of dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, please love me. and I'll do anything if you.
Just as long as you pat me on the head.
Yeah.
I just love that. One of my very first dreams in Missouri was a one sentence voice, you have to learn to love cats. Yeah. I didn't used to like cats, but now I've changed. Okay. Now, it gets a little complicated. Second column. We're doing pretty good today. So a lot of this we've done in different contexts, but given the complicated nature of giving, given that he's realized there is something like the self that is our first responsibility to develop. How do we understand what a healthy relationship to the self is? And how do we understand what the nature of giving is from a person in touch with the self versus a person who's not in touch with the self? That's what he's doing for the next second column on 338. And then the first column, 339. And what's that have to do with God? All of this is provisional thinking. That may be why you feel it's, certainly I thought it was confusing. Because he's laying out thoughts that later have been superseded. So, just to finish up our thought process at the top of 338, second column, what we neglect in ourselves blends itself secretly into our actions toward others. That's more of the same. See where I am. Maybe even we should go, I should have gone a sentence before that. But through constant outer life, we forget the self. And through this, we also become secretly selfish in our best endeavors. So what does it mean to forget the self, to remember the self? How do you not get selfish? These are just questions. We don't have answers yet. And then he says, through uniting with the self, we reach the God. Now, that is old thinking. He completely changed that. But he's letting his confused ideas just come into him.
What do you mean he completely changed?
Well, he does make a distinction between the self and God. And he doesn't talk about God.
Right.
He talks about the God image.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
And boy, this causes more misunderstanding. And it seems to irritate everybody. Jung is not doing theology. He is presenting records of people's experiences and dreams in which what has traditionally been used to depict God is used by the dreams to depict our selfhood. That makes sense. What interests him is how the psyche uses the images that have traditionally been used to depict God to depict selfhood. So the self and the God image are two different words for the same thing. And people jump in and say, is that God? And Jung says, that is a meaningless question. Because how would we know? And somebody say, but I believe in God. And Jung says, I'm not interested in belief. Now, the way I like to address those folks is to say, I'll throw this sentence out, it may sound confusing, so we might want to go through it. Jung replaces metaphysical certainty with ethical obligation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Jung replaces metaphysical certainty with ethical obligation. In other words, it's an absolutely irrelevant question whether or not that God image is God. The important question is, what is that God image asking of you? And the people who are so hung up on whether that's God or not, you can be sure they're not listening to and following the dictates of their God image. Once you do, the question drops away.
Places metaphysical certainty
with ethical obligation.
I think also that the question is a personal question. What is the image asking of you?
Yeah.
Not what is the image asking you to make sure everybody else does.
Yeah. That's exactly right, Anne. That's exactly right.
I think like the kids father and it was the preacher that had facilitating, like, right, that just blows my mind. Somebody told me one time that arthritis is such a disease of the deposit, as in you're holding on.
Yeah, well, not just a preacher. This guy is one of the biggest names in what they call process theology, in which God is seen in the process. What kind of crap is that?
What?
What does that mean? It means absolutely nothing.
Seen in what process? Of life?
Process of life.
Of life. Yes.
And that's Paul Tillich somewhat. But this is the guy they read at CTS all the time.
Well, this is the father we're talking about now?
The father is the big theologian. Yeah. And you can see it's just air. And his son said that. We just talked. My dad was the most rigid person, and he passed it on to me. So that's an example of what he neglects in himself, blending into his action toward his son. And so when Jung now is opening up the question, which he doesn't answer, well, he does a little bit, but which I think he spent many, many years trying to answer, this relationship between God, the God image, and the self. And what he came to was that we can never know God, but what we can know is what the God image is asking of us, and that's the new, if you want to mix metaphors a bit, that's the new theology.
And the self? Can we know the self?
I think you can know what it's asking of you.
So what the God image and the self are sort of...
Same thing. Just two different words for the same thing.
Okay.
Or you might say the self, one of the ways, it might be a little more accurate to say, one of the ways the self is manifested is in God image.
And that can be unique for everyone?
Yeah, I think it's both unique
and
predictable.
And then there's a collective God image as well.
Yeah.
And those things are always under some kind of transformation.
Certainly in our period of history, definitely. Okay. Probably always.
But in the individual, once the self manifests in the individual, does it also transform?
Yes.
Okay.
That's where you get the
Atman
and the
Bhagavan.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, it gets a little more complicated because of synchronicity. It seems when working on the self, synchronistic events are more likely to happen. And what we've talked about a little bit in the Berkuser material, it does look like there is part of us that lives after death. And it looks like that could be the self. So the self isn't limited to time and space. But for Jung, this is not getting into theology. It's simply the phenomenology of the self. And he is completely happy leaving it there, and so am I. Because how many people do you know who talk about their belief in God and they are complete hypocrites? That's what Jung is trying to get rid of. That the religious act is living the identity you were given.
You know, I'm showing this little thing. If it sounds irrelevant, just tell me. I was reading...
I'm glad somebody looked.
Okay, I won't apologize.
Good.
Women who run with wolves, I'm getting so much stuff out, and I tried to read it like 20 years ago, and it didn't hit. But they have this example in there that just about made me sick, and it feels like what happens to a person who then doesn't get in touch with herself.
Yeah.
But they were doing an experiment with dogs to find out how they adjusted to things. So they have this cage
And on one side of the cage, it was electrified. The other side wasn't. So when the dog went over there, he got a shock. Well, it didn't take too long. He knew to stay on the other side. So then they switch it, you know, sort of the other way. So then the dog knows to go to the other side. Then they electrocute the whole thing. And at first, you know, the dog panics because there's no place he can go and not get shot. But then finally, he just lays down and gives up.
Yeah.
And when they open the door, he just didn't go out.
Yeah.
He just...
Yeah.
Is this an actual experiment someone did?
Ah, oh, science.
Yeah.
God.
Well, it's like that experiment, little detail, but detour, but important one. That was done on Kaczynski.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Exactly what I was thinking.
Don't you? You're familiar with that, aren't you?
You were telling us about it here one day.
I thought you were.
I didn't know if you were about it.
Well, where did I hear about it?
Sandy. Right. I saw the figure.
Yes. On video.
Yeah. Right.
I saw the show.
Murray.
Henry Murray.
Yeah. But he was the experimenter.
Yeah.
He
had an experiment where he had students from undergraduate write essays on their value system. And I think it was presented to them as, we're doing a study about value systems, and you will be interviewed by a graduate psychologist just to probe how your values work in your life. And half of the responders were interviewed by wasn't a graduate student in psychology, I don't think. And they were discussed, the essay was discussed positively. The other half, the essay was torn to pieces. This is stupid, you know, you're superficial, this is ridiculous. And one of those was Ted Kaczynski, whose essay was torn to pieces. And I think it was a PBS show on the Unabomber. And it said he was not the same afterwards.
Didn't they build him in that it was just like...
Probably eventually, but with a fragile personality. I may not
it
have
had
made
its
any,
effect had anyway. Its,
anyway.
Actually, I don't know that they did, because I think nowadays there are very strict guidelines on how you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think those strict guidelines came out of those experiments where they just shredded people psychologically and then never told them.
Well, it gives you an idea what the self is and how powerful that thing is. I think I told you in my own training that I had this horrible analyst to begin with. And, you know, I'd have these dreams of science, and he'd say to me, well, I'm like, you know, you shouldn't be here. You should be on a science program. This is what you're doing. And he just smashed that part of me. And until I started dreaming, I was going psychotic. And I got myself out of him, thank God, and went to the woman I ended up working with for the next 7 years. The first hour I said something about theology. She said, theology? Why would you want to study theology? You're a scientist. Dreams, she picked that right up. My dreams of going crazy stopped that moment. That you have to develop your own core, and that's what he's driving at here. And that's your task.
Well, wait a minute. The first guy I thought was putting you down for science.
Yeah. He's saying, you know, you're dreaming of science. You have no, you know, you shouldn't be here.
Shouldn't be at the
Jung Institute.
At the Jung Institute. And she's saying, okay, you're a scientist, but be here.
Yeah, and be here. Okay. And not knowing where it would lead, von Franz hadn't even started publishing on her science stuff yet, but kept that side of me alive until this Pauli material came out and I could work on it. So it turned out it was an integral part of my training. Yeah. But it drove home to me what the self is and how violently it reacts when it's not developed, when there's a pressure for development.
In Kaczynski's case, it emerged in his antisocial behavior.
Yeah. If you have no outlet, you do go crazy.
Blow up the world.
Blew up the world, yeah.
He was, that was, him and Mary was like the second traumatic experience when he was a baby. His mother and his brother were in 60 minutes. And she said when he was a baby, he was put in the hospital because he, I don't know, he had a, maybe it was encephalitis. And they, then they isolated the children, didn't let their parents right. stay with him or anybody. They just isolated him. And she said when he came, and he was just a toddler, when she got him back from the hospital and this horrible theory or treatment that they did them, that he was a different child.
Mm-hmm.
She said he was totally different. And obviously, they, she gave all the symptoms where he had never been that way before. And she thought it was the treatment in reference, not so much the disease that he had that mm-hmm. they were able to cure him of, but the treatment gave him abandonment.
Well, that all underscores, I think, the importance of what Jung is doing. I don't know if we need to go through every sentence here, but he is trying to figure out what's the relationship between self and God. And that pretty much he goes through that whole second column.
He says down here, God is our heaviest wound.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where is that?
It's sort of the top of that paragraph. It's really a good
thing. You want to read it?
Okay. Yeah, the God appears to us in a certain state of the soul. Therefore, we reach the God through the self. Not the self is God, although we reach the God through the self. The God is behind the self, above the self. The self is self when he appears. But he appears as our sickness from which we must heal ourselves. We must heal ourselves from the God, since he is also our heaviest wound. It is much heavier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see the truth in that. You can also see how he's not quite clear how the self and God relate to each other.
Yeah, that's what I mean right now. But if God is our heaviest wound, and we work on that wound, then we get to the self.
Well, we are working on. Well, I think in later language he would have said something like the self is our heaviest wound, or our supreme value is manifested in our heaviest wound, and that's the same thing as the experience of God.
Because in the next paragraph, he kind of indicates that we have to wrestle the self away from God.
Right. Again, that continues for a couple of paragraphs, mm-hmm. and that's old thinking.
Okay.
That's all old thinking. But where so he goes, I'll just, maybe I'll allude to this and then we'll pick up again because it's important. He's unclear about the relationship of self and God, and he's unclear, I'm going to use the word self slash God. He's unclear, am I the self slash God? Is the self slash God in me? Am I in the self slash God? What's the relationship between these two entities? And it is not resolved, but he spent a long time later figuring that out. And I think where the confusion starts is in, it depends on your age, what the answer to that question is. Originally, you are the self. That's why children are so endearing. They're just this bundle of authenticity. Unfortunately, they can't poop in the toilet. And they have to go through school and things like that, so that the development of life separates those two. So for part of the time, you separate from God. And then later in midlife, you return to the self and you start listening to it. In a way, it contains you. In a way, you contain it. You serve it. You follow you try to understand its intent and you follow it. So in a way, it defines your whole life. But yet, since it's a dialogue, you're responsible for what happens. So all of the things he raises here, is it this, is it that, is it this, is it that, they're all true from a different angle at a different phase in life. But he hasn't worked that out yet.
Is he possibly unclear about whether self here should be in caps or not?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like, you know, if you just substitute ego or the smaller idea of self, that would, that's what he's talking about.
I think he's talking about the self as the archetype of our central being. Now, where it's problematic, as you know, Carl, in German, all nouns are capitalized. It's caused enormous arguments in my field.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I mean, there's a whole, I think that London group split over, do you capitalize or not capitalize the self? It's absurd. But...
Oh, I see, yeah.
I don't know how I feel. Really. If it's not capitalized, it makes it sound like every other part of life. But it's not every other part of life. It is the central part of life. So that leads me to say, okay, capitalize it. On the other hand, if it's capitalized, that puts it in the realm of God. And as we've seen, we have to listen to the self, but we also have to distinguish what we accept of the self. And if it's looked as a sacred entity only, then you don't dialogue with it.
And it will ask much more of you than you as a human being come up.
And more than you can handle. So that, in a sense, you and the self are equal. In a sense, you and the self are not equal. And none of that is clear, but that certainly has caused a lot of discussion in my field.
Probably capitalizing it needs that dignity. With the small s, I tend to sort of equate with ego.
Yeah. Now, of course, this has been translated, yeah. Right? So the original would have been capital S, though the choice of small s is the editor's.
Yeah.
But we're just out of time, but. The reason there are so many thoughts here that are flying all over the place, which he then completely reverses his opinion on in those paragraphs before the number four, is because all of the things he says are partially true as descriptions of the self under certain conditions, seen with a partial eye. But he hasn't gotten there yet. But I thought, why don't we hold off and we'll pick up with that.
Let's rediscuss that.
Yeah, we'll pick up with that. We'll pick up with the God appears to us in a certain state of the soul.
Okay.
We'll pick up with that and we'll look at all the sentences. But I think if you realize each thing he says is kind of true, and then what we have to do is make a composite picture, where here he's going, is it this or this? And the fact is, it's neither and it's both. And then we'll try to ascertain that. And that's what he spent, you know, decades trying to get straight. How does that self work? How does its symbolism relate to religious symbolism? How does it relate to synchronicity? How does it relate to life after death? None of it, we can't know any of it for certain, but we certainly can speculate.
This all kind of came out of the discussion or the image that we were talking about last time where the self was both the God and the snake with the flathead or the tamar.
Yeah. Yeah, it's both the devil and, well, it's the snake and it's the spirit. It's personal and universal. Or it would be more accurate to say there's an aspect of it. Because it's so multifaceted that it requires many contradictory descriptions to be true to its reality. That's because, it's not because we're stupid, it's because logic can't grasp the illogical, non-logical. Okay, let's see, we've got to, I'll say we got to 338. Why don't you read to 4, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Where's 5? Is at the top of one of the pages. Yeah. So if you read to 342, we're picking up speed because a lot of it is wordy. So if I had you read to number 6, why don't you read to 345? We may not get there. Read to before 6, second column. I think some of this will go faster, some will have to go slow with, but he's presenting more concepts. But it'll get harder, don't worry. Just when you think you're going to relax, forget it.
I will never worry about that.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'll see you in 2 weeks.
I really
And I'll email you PDFs of Carl's photocopy.